Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council Incorporated. Her website's jugglingdynamite.com and venablepark.com. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jim.
Everybody's worried after the collapse of two banks in the U.S., the Silicon Valley Bank and the Signature Bank in New York. Moody's is now downgrading the U.S. banking system to negative. Do we have to worry about our banking system in Canada? And could the U.S. system drag us down even if we're so-called healthy?
Well, it really depends on what way you're referring to that. I mean, it is very much interconnected. So definitely what happens in the U.S. banking system impacts the financial markets significantly. You know, it's 14% of the S&P basket. And what happens in the economy and the banking sector in the United States impacts the global economy, impacts Canada very closely because we're such a significant trading partner. All of the impact on our currency markets. So yes, it's all very interrelated. It's also very connected to real estate, which, as you know, is a major vulnerability that Canada has this cycle, Jim, as we've discussed many times. But basically, at the nub of it, if you're talking about, you know, are our banks at risk of collapse, that's a different conversation entirely. So what I would say is you need to distinguish between the share prices of these institutions, their actual balance sheet and liquidity, and their ability to, you know, protect and preserve deposits. So there's a bunch of factors there, and it's important to understand what you're talking about when you make these comparisons. But when you look at, for example, Silicon Valley Bank, it's been around for about 40 years. But in the last, you know, since about 2015, we really had a big boom in the tech sector, which was brought on by all the QE and the loose credit, zero rates, money looking for something to do because it was getting nothing at the banks. As you know, that whole trend was really went into a big crescendo during the pandemic when even more cash was thrown at financial assets and markets and, you know, looking for things to do. And so we saw, for example, that at Silicon Valley Bank, the amount of deposits they had from customers actually tripled from the end of 2019 to the end of 2021. So they were a major benefactor of all the cash that was coming into that sector. You know, share prices were in a massive bubble, so a lot of the tech companies were able to capitalize on that. And to some extent, they were able to use the funds to you know, accelerate business models, like certainly Tesla benefited from a lot of that liquidity that was flushing around, and they used it to, you know, build out their infrastructure and their capacity and their production and all that stuff. Other companies were able to use it in, you know, less productive ways. Companies like Facebook, for example, had massive liquidity. They also ramped up their overhead operating expenses, you know, added a whole bunch of sort of superfluous services and sort of cushy things. And as you've seen now, they're, even them, you know, even these well-established companies have hit this QT portion of the economic cycle the last year, when central banks really, as we've said, hiked rates at the fastest pace since 1980 to really get ahead of something they'd fallen behind on, which was this inflationary impulse that came from all the spending and money flowing through the economy. So really what you had is this sort of big jolt. So you had the jolt to the upside in terms of so much cash and paying customers nothing on those deposits meant that banks were doing all sorts of things to magnify their own spreads and profits. So in the case of some of the smaller banks, like the Silicon Valley Bank, you know, anything under $200 billion in assets is considered sort of smaller size. It's not one of the large, too-big-to-fail institutions, which have been more heavily regulated this cycle because they blew up in 2008, as you know. They were given more capital stringency in terms of what they had to have for insured deposits. You know, about 60% of their deposits are insured by government underwriting, so the CDIC coverage in Canada or the FDIC coverage in the United States. But when you look at some of these small regional banks, they lobbied really hard to be left out of those stringent capital requirements. And now we're starting to see the fallout of that, right? So they had this easy money time, capital flowing in, and because they were paying so little out to people, they decided to earn spread on that money. So they did things like put, in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, put 90% of their deposit funds into what they considered longer term. 90% of their deposits were not, in fact, insured by the government backup capital insurance on the accounts, and they used up to, you know, a huge amount, something like 60% or 50% of the money they took in, they put into long-dated securities. So these were like mortgage-backed securities. They bought a huge amount of mortgage-backed securities in 2021 with an average yield of 1.68%. Well, of course, what's happened in the last year as, you know, rates were ratcheted up so quickly and mortgage rates tripled and quadrupled, the value of those existing assets plunged. Now, initially, they thought that wasn't a problem because they were holding them on what's called held to maturity. So if you hold some of those, unlike equities, which never have a maturity date, as I've described before, you know, treasuries and things that are underwritten by the government have fixed maturity dates. So if you can hold them to that date, they will pay you your interest every 6 months and they will give you back your principal. So there is no actual credit risk, but what there is there's a mismatch of duration risk there. So the deposits can be required to be withdrawn. Customers come in and start asking for money back. And you've got, you know, 50% of that money in these long-dated instruments. That means that at some point, you're not going to have enough cash to cover the withdrawals that are being requested. And that's really accelerated in the last year because the, you know, people woke up late to the reality that they can get more than 4% now on a money market fund or GIC or in some of these high interest savings accounts. And the banks, as we actually discussed a couple of weeks ago, were still offering next to nothing because they're making these fat spreads, right? They take in the money and put reserves with the central bank where those reserves are earning the overnight rate, so 4.5, 4.75. And what a great scheme for them if they don't pay anything to the depositors. Of course, it all came back to bite them because the depositors said, hey, I can get money. I can actually earn compound interest. This is a new novel concept for many people. I don't have to leave it there getting nothing and being treated like crap, like trash, as they all kept telling us. Cash is trash, and they were treating it with such disrespect. Well, what that manifested in was a bunch of people coming and asking and quickly moving with phone apps these days and online banking. Money is quite fluid, right? When it wants to move, it doesn't take a long time to get accounts open and move it elsewhere. So that was really happening at the same time you've got this big downturn in the economic cycle where cash flow is being much less free cash flow flowing around. You know, securities markets are not cooperating. There hasn't been a lot of new issues. So a lot of these companies have not been raising capital like they were during the pandemic. In fact, they've been drawing down on money. You know, their operating cash is in those bank accounts, and they kept asking for more and more of it back. Well, it quickly, you know, compounds into a crisis when the company now has to look at, like Silicon Valley Bank did, has to look at selling those assets that they, if they could hold them to maturity, they'd be sure to get their principal back. But because they have had so many demands for capital, they have to actually sell those things early. Well, that then hits their balance sheet and it hits as a negative on their income statement, and suddenly their, you know, liquidity evaporates and they're in dire financial shape. So that's in fact what happened. And these things are contagious. So it's happening, you know, to Signature Bank, which is another entity that failed over the weekend. And then, you know, the Signature Bank had 12% of its did 12% of the commercial real estate lending in the New York metro area. So this is how you get this feedback loop, you know, out of tech. Not just tech and bioscience companies were being supported by these smaller lenders that weren't managing their balance sheets appropriately. They were drunk on liquidity during the pandemic, and they didn't manage their risk appropriately. They were all about how do we maximize profits rather than how do we maintain, you know, security and stability of the institution. So when you get these blow-ups, they tend to be contagious to other institutions, and they also tend to have knock-on effects to other sectors. So that's why I was writing today about, you know, now we're seeing this liquidity crunch hit beyond just tech and beyond just Silicon Valley, and you're getting, for example, Credit Suisse, which has had all sorts of troubles, and basically UBS, Credit Suisse, these are the companies that have been doing all manner of irresponsible things the past few years and getting away with it. Well, of course, you get into a credit crunch and their share price starts to fall as well. And they can't issue new shares when their share price is crashing because that just lowers the price even further. And then they also start to have a liquidity problem. So that's what we're starting to see now. Credit Suisse, of course, is deemed a too big to fail institution. They have been held to stricter requirements for cash on the balance sheet. So I'm not saying that depositors there are, you know, at risk of losing their money or anything. But again, if we're looking at the institution and its equity price, we're likely to see that it needs to have someone take it over, or it needs to somehow raise capital, which is very difficult in this environment. And that's why, you know, I think that the overall markets are, the overall stock markets are reflecting all of this stuff that's going on, all the pistons that are breaking and the firing underneath the infrastructure of the world economy and the financial sector, because we've had too long of easy money, too long of easy rates, too much, you know, lax, no one knowing how to manage risk and just throwing stuff at the wall and see if it'll stick. And now, of course, we're in the cleanup phase.
We'll have more with Danielle Park right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Danielle Park. So, of course, this goes back to Roman times. Cicero said if the outlying markets were in trouble, eventually it ends up in Rome. Will this eventually end up in New York and London?
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing, you touched on it in the first segment, and I forgot to respond to it, but you mentioned that Moody's has downgraded the outlook. They did this yesterday. They downgraded the outlook for the entire U.S. banking system. Now, that's not to say that they think that all of U.S. banks are going bankrupt, but they're saying that we're in a fundamentally different environment here where capital is contracting out of all the major sectors of the economy. Bank lending is in decline. Profits are under enormous pressure, especially in finance, because, as I said, now the pressure is on. If they want to keep those deposits, they have to start offering people actual income on their cash to keep it in-house. And that's going to be a very negative impact on the profits of the big banks, because they've been gouging these fat spreads for a while now and using that. So there's that. There's the volume of their loans are down. They're getting hit on their balance sheet from their assets that they are holding. The ones that are available for sale are the ones they're having to sell. That includes, you know, a lot of commercial properties that they'll be looking for buyers. They typically turn to things like private equity at this part of the cycle and say, hey, can we sell you a bunch of this stuff? Or in some cases, the commercial or the developers in the real estate space will turn to the lenders, the banks, and the other institutions who have fronted money in the last few years and say, hey, we can't make this work. We're going to give you back the property. And so this is where you get, you know, those type of institutions don't typically want to hold properties or manage properties. They just want to get the cash flows. And that starts becoming a widespread push for things coming on the market for sale just their time, and there's less people willing or able to purchase them. So, yes, it's very contagious. It tends to spread throughout all the major sectors and the major centers. I think that, you know, I do think that I'm more heartened this time in the sense of the major banks have trillions of dollars. Because of the regulations that came in after the great financial crisis, they were required to hold much higher capital ratios and to have much more guaranteed deposits on the books. And so there's trillions of dollars in bank reserves on deposit at central banks in the world right now. And that is a buffer that they can draw on to protect deposits. And so I don't see the same crunch in the respect of the larger institutions. Now, I know that there's a lot of people who have done sketchy things and not paid attention to the credit quality of the institution they've been either lending to or buying securities or properties through. Again, you know, what we've learned, Jim, through decades and decades of experience all the way back to Rome, is that if you make conditions ultra loose and ultra easy, it doesn't breed the best sailors or the best risk managers, right? It tends to do the opposite. It raises a whole generation of people that are weak and don't know it. They think they're genius when in fact they're just reckless. And so that's why it always makes these periods that much more magnified and difficult for when it actually does hit the economy. And, you know, not to be so hard on Moody's, but all of these major auditors and risk assessors, the irony, of course, which was writ large in The Big Short when the rating agencies didn't do anything pre the financial crisis in terms of downgrading, they really haven't done anything this time either. I mean, to come out after, you know, the two banks have closed and say, oops, if other banks have been managing the balance sheet this way, then we need to review the entire outlook. And we know for sure other banks have been. Moody's named several of them, but we know that this kind of behavior and risk management style has been widely adopted, and certainly wherever regulation was lax enough to allow it. So that is a lot of the second tier lending institutions. But also, you know, these banks that just went bankrupt were audited by the big, you know, KPMGs of the world. And of course, no one is catching this stuff because the incentives in the system are all wrong. They're all on, you know, magnifying the upside and very little concern for what can go wrong. And that's why it makes, you know, like our job at our company when we're actually trying to manage risk and control the risk of loss to capital, it makes our job much harder when you're in an environment sort of surrounded by drunks at a party and you're the only sober one. So, you know, not that I'm happy to see any of this carnage hit, but it was inevitable. And so I think it's much better for us to get on with this repricing portion and to let the chips fall where they may, and to have, you know, prices come back down significantly, which is so essential. It's important to understand, Jim, that, you know, in these recessionary bear markets that have taken place, say, in the last 100 years, it's quite common, actually, to see the entire upcycle and all the gains that the market made in the, you know, liquidity piling on portion to be taken back in the down cycle. So if you think about that, we have so much further to go here in terms of the extent of the overvaluation and extreme bubbles that were blown during the pandemic. We're down, you know, about 18% on the banks in Canada. It would be more typical to see them off about 40 at least in this environment. So if that sector continues to decline in this environment, then you're likely to see the TSX follow, because it's, you know, as I said, about 31% in the financial sector, not to mention the fact that oil was crushed yesterday. I don't know if you caught that, Jim, but WTI was trading down to $70 a barrel this morning. This is all part of the realization that demand is contracting worldwide, and we're into a recessionary environment that will see demand of all sorts of things come off. That's awesome for inflation. That's the right impulse in terms of lowering the cost of living, but it will be a problem, as they say, in this ongoing liquidity problem.
Yes, when you say lower demand, I live across from a container port in Vancouver, and it can go for days without any ships being there. Before, it was always packed.
Yeah, there you go, right? That's exactly right. That's what we're seeing in the shipping data, in the cost, you know, the Baltic Dry Index. These things are off more than 80% from the peak. And those are all sort of leading indicators for the economic cycle, you know. So we definitely, you know, because the Fed stayed loose for so long, because they continued QE for so long, they did extend this cycle, there's no question. My concern is they've actually magnified the extent of the downturn or the negative part that's now unfolding. And you can't, it's, you know, they say there's no free lunch. There isn't any free lunch. When you borrow too much and spend too much on credit, there's a payback period, and that's what we're in right now.
How does the average person brace themselves here? Is there anything you can do?
Yeah, there's lots you can do. A lot of it is, you know, something you should be thinking about before these periods come. As I say, you can't afford to be drunk with the crowd because the crowd is you know, not paying attention. So sobriety and care around money is very important. Managing liquidity is very important. You know, you have to have enough capital set aside in liquid things to pay your bills. You have to have enough savings. You have to keep your debt low to none, ideally, for all the reasons that people are learning right now. You know, it is not the same thing. A line of credit is nowhere near the same thing as having actual cash that you can draw on in times of need. As I've said before, the really good part of this is that people are learning that again and that cash is being rewarded. And as the asset prices fall for all these other long duration things that, you know, were overpriced in the last few years, the opportunity for buying things that are going to be really high yielding and much lower risk and real investment grade, you know, that category of things is improving by the day as this stuff is happening. So the worst thing you can do is be fully allocated to these risky assets as they go into a recessionary bear market and tend to lose about half their value, or worse, be in things that are so sketchy that they get, you know, frozen or they don't trade. People are starting to learn that right now. Gates are coming down on some of this high-spec stuff that, you know, everyone thought was a no-brainer while money was flowing, but now they're realizing there wasn't much brains going on inside at all, and they can't get their money back out of it. So you want to look at your liquidity. You want to make sure you don't have all your savings in these high-risk assets that are tumbling right now, and you want to make sure that you have cash built up, both as an emergency buffer, but also as a buying fund for when the dust finally settles. Now, we know that, you know, right now the central banks are still expected to hike rates. The ECB was talking like it still plans to hike 50 basis points tomorrow. We shall see. This Credit Suisse debacle that's happening may indeed take the steam out from under them. And, you know, they were the same crew who were promising to not hike rates for a year that turned on a dime and suddenly slashed them, hiked them 75 beeps ago there for almost a year. So they are very reactionary as well. They're like the auditors. They don't see much coming. They always react after the fact. Like a week ago, the expectation was central banks would hike all the way through 2023. And now Fed fund futures are starting to price the expectation of 100 basis points of cuts from the U.S. Fed over the next 12 months. So right now we're at this tipping point of, you know, they never wait till inflation is 2% before they actually start cutting. We've never seen that in the past cycle. Inflation was always above 3% at when they finally capitulate and start cutting going into these downturns, because the horror of the losses in the stock market in particular and the dysfunction that starts to unfold in the high-risk credit market is such that it scares the bejeebers out of the central banks. And unemployment starts to spike, which is already now happening. And that is finally the thing that forces them back to the sidelines and ultimately back to cutting. However, typically they won't go back to cutting. Even if they were to pause now, they wouldn't start cutting for several months just to try and save face on the fact they were hiking rates as just recently. So they have to obviously give some time in between. Otherwise, it looks like it's a complete farce. So ultimately, we should expect that the stock market probably won't bottom for another, you know, perhaps 8 to 12 months, something like that. It could happen faster because of liquidity problems. You could see a bottom perhaps, you know, maybe in 6 months, but it's not likely to be happening anytime soon, and we've never seen a bottom in financial markets when the Fed had not even started cutting yet. So I think, you know, we're early in this game is my overall take. and it's not too late to, you know, batten down the hatches.
Danielle, what about people who have money deposited in places like credit unions? They're not under federal regulation. Should people be worried about them?
They have typically their own provincial insurance on those accounts backstopped, so they should be okay. Basically, at this stage of the game, the liquidity issue is not with respect to governments and their ability to, you know, tax and raise revenue and backstop these systems. So I think, you know, basically those institutions should be okay. But you have to always kind of do some due diligence and be aware of what, you know, my concern in some of those lower tier institutions is, again, kind of like in the regional banks in the U.S., to what extent have they taken on too much risk in highly leveraged sectors like real estate? To what extent did they manage their cash properly, and how much of their deposits have been put in long-dated assets that they may indeed have to now sell early to raise cash? That is really the question. So that's a hard question to just answer off the top of one's head. You have to look at the institutions involved.
Danielle, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Danielle Park, editor of the popular blog Juggling Dynamite and president of Venable Park Investment Council, Incorporated. If you have any questions for Danielle or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.